Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and this program has been about the evolution of consciousness. And I've been talking with my guest now. What exactly is evolution? What is consciousness? I'm talking to David Sloan
Wilson,
and he is a professor of biology. He's also written a bunch of books about what was your last one called? The altruism.
Does altruism exist?
Does altruism exist? But he is an evolutionary biologist, and that's something I'm very interested in. We were just talking today with Bruce Lipton, another evolutionary biologist. But I want to get your point of view, David, about evolution on a biological sense. Is that still a process that's happening? I mean, do we see signs of evolutionary biology within the natural world?
Oh, yes, of course we do. And one of the discoveries over the last decades, not a new discovery, is that evolution can be a much faster process than we've thought. For most people, and including Darwin, thought of evolution as a very slow process, so slow that you can only see the product, not the process. Mm-hmm. Now we know that evolution can take place on ecological timescales. A single generation can be enough to shift gene frequency changes. And that's true for our own species. So evolution didn't slow down in our species, it sped up. And there's a wonderful book called The 10,000-Year Explosion about how the pace of genetic evolution, this is before we even get to cultural evolution, which is also an evolutionary process.
Right, we'll talk about culture, but let's start with biological. So species can change its species specialization within one generation? Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's two parts to evolution. One is the change that takes place within a population or a species.
Right.
And the other is the creation of new species.
Well, that's what I would say. Oh, so, I mean, within a population would be an adaptational feature, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes.
But adaptation doesn't necessarily lead to specialization.
I mean, no, those are separate processes.
Right.
It can. If you have, for example, if you have crudely speaking, a two-niche environment.
Right.
Okay. Many lakes, for example, they have the open water, they have the edge, the vegetated edge, and those call for different adaptations. Right. So what happens when you put a single species of fish in a lake and there's two niches? It will diversify, and sometimes it will split into two different species. The split is easier when you have geographical isolation. So when a species becomes divided into two isolated populations and there's no gene flow, then there's a process of divergence, as you might expect, even by chance. And ultimately, they become so different from each other that they become separate species. And this has been documented many times over. None of this is controversial. I want you to know that.
I want
your readers know that.
But species, different species means they're not breedable anymore. Is that how you define a species? Two non-breedable populations of animals, let's say.
That's the conventional definition, is populations that don't interbreed.
Right.
In fact, it's more complicated than that. For example, you can have asexual species, no sex anywhere. And yet they still cluster into different what you would recognize as a species. You could also have a species that they're definitely good species, but they've been isolated for a very long time. But dang, if you do interbreed them, they're capable of interbreeding.
Is that humans and monkeys, are they capable?
No, not that would be too great of a distance.
Okay,
but there's other examples. And
I guess horses and zebras, or is that
not my area.
Let's stick with your area because you have so many expertise within the area that you've studied. So the process of evolution that would cause a species to evolve within a generation or whatever is an environmental shift, right? It's a drastic change within an environment.
Well, let me cut right to an interesting example.
Okay.
Human history, way back, a number of different human populations developed the practice of raising livestock.
Right.
And that made milk available to adults Right. For the first time in mammalian history, milk became a food source for adult humans, adult mammals. They did not have the ability to genetically, the genetic ability to digest lactose. That's something that all infants have, but tend to be lost in adults. So now a cultural practice led to a new genetic selection pressure for the ability to digest lactose in adults. And because raising livestock is a cultural practice that developed independently in more than one human population, this is like an independent experiment.
Right.
And in each case, these populations did evolve genetically. They evolved to the ability to digest lactose, but the mutations were different, and so the specific metabolic pathways were different in each case, as you would expect.
Right, right.
So there's a case of rapid human genetic evolution, all taking place within the last few thousand years, and also a case in which cultural evolution led the way. So a cultural practice reconfigured the genetic selection pressured, and this is something that happens quite often. So there's a co-evolutionary process between cultural change and genetic change has been going on for a long time.
But of course, not everyone is lactose tolerant. I mean, there's still some, I mean, I don't think I can digest milk.
Yeah, because in places on Earth where livestock was not domesticated, there was never a reason to evolve that, and so the majority of people are actually lactose intolerant because their ancestors came from these other populations.
But how is evolution happening now, and how do we see it, and where are we going as a civilization? Don't we need to have awareness of something bigger where community? I mean, do you see that as, I mean, I'm talking about culturally, I guess, but where are we going as a human species if you're looking at evolution?
Well, the first thing you need to know is, I'm going to give a conventional answer and then a more expansive answer.
Good.
What made Darwin's theory different than other theories of evolution, including Spencer's theory, which we were just talking previously about Spencer, was that Darwin's theory is not progressive. It's very local. All it does, basically, is it selects for adaptations to the local environment, like the one that I just stated.
Right.
Where humanity is going, or where any species is going, that's too macro a question. The only thing that's happening is that individuals differ. Some do better than others in their local environment. And then based on that relative advantage, that's what you end up with.
That's the standard.
That's it.
That's standard.
And then you die.
That's Darwinian. I mean, or neo-Darwinian.
Yeah. And so some of these big picture questions, what does evolution have to do with consciousness?
Right.
Where is humanity going? Mm-hmm. Can the earth, can we evolve to be more sustainable practices?
Yes.
It turns out that actually you need to embrace and understand this sort of local lidded aspect of evolution before you can answer that question. And so to begin at a small scale, and this is what I am an expert at, is just imagine not the big question about humanity, but just imagine a nice person, nice individual who helps others, them with a not so nice individual, and then just ask the question, who's going to lead the most offspring? And the simple answer is, if we don't embellish the story, is that nice guys finish last, basically. If I'm extending myself to you and you're accepting my benefits and you're not reciprocating, then I'll do better than you, and selfishness will carry the day.
So, and they'll have more offsprings, and they'll be more selfish people,
and altruism will go away. So Darwin was confronted with this. At first, Darwin thought that his theory could explain everything, all aspects of design that had previously been attributed to the creator. But then when he thought about it a little more, he realized this was not the case, that these social adaptations, anything that's for the good of the group, for the good of others, actually, he would have difficulty explaining for the reason that I just stated. The solid citizen is is less fit than the slacker and the exploiter within the same group. But he didn't have to look far to find at least a partial answer to that question, which is, although selfishness beats altruism within groups, a group of altruists, a group of solid citizens, mm-hmm. will robustly outcompete a group of slackers and exploiters. So
would that be like how coyotes hunt together in a pack, as sure. opposed to one that's like taking it all for themselves?
Sure. Things going on. Mm. So, in coyotes hunting in a pack, then they too will have cooperators and non-cooperators. Right. The non-cooperators will have the real advantage, but a pack of cooperators will do better than a pack of non-cooperators.
Well, that's a reflection of where we are as humanity now, right?
In a sense, it is at large scale. So just to consolidate our gains here, what that means is that evolution can explain the evolution of niceness in all its forms, but special conditions are required. There must be a process of selection among groups. There must be variation groups, and that process must be sufficiently strong to outweigh the opposing process of selection within groups. That's multi-level selection in a nutshell. What it explains how prosociality, niceness in all its form, can evolve by a Darwinian process, but does not necessarily evolve. Mm. And then the rest is commentary, basically, as to what actually happened. Can evolve. What can happen at the scale of small groups might not happen at the scale of larger groups.
But is altruism a genetic trait, or is it a learned social within the hardwired within the species? That's something that happens, or is it something that's learned and acquired through
we do as a heritable component. People are innately more inclined to be altruistic. At the same time, we all have choices. Mm-hmm. And but what's really interesting about that question, the outcome when altruism is a matter of individual choice, let's say that we all have equal capacity to be altruistic or selfish, and we make a decision based on our local circumstances. Mm-hmm. The outcome of that scenario was actually not so much different than a model for the genetic evolution of altruism. Mm-hmm. In both cases, what's needed for altruism to either evolve as a genetic trait or to be expressed as a behavioral trait, right, is something where the altruist can cluster together and to confine their interactions to each other and avoid the depredations of the selfish individual. So if you were flexible and if you were smart, you would be altruistic in the company of other altruists, and then you'd turn it off in the company of other of selfish individuals. Mm-hmm. That would be the smart thing to do.
But you're just talking basic biology in a sense. You get a greater sense, I don't know, if you go there, spiritual nature where we are here to evolve a sense of this greater self and to give back. And it actually feels better to help someone else than to just take it all for yourself. Get into that or not really?
Sure. Well, let me take a couple of giant strides to get there as fast as possible.
Okay.
So one is, why are we so different than all other primate species?
That's a good place to start.
And the quick answer is because we're a lot more cooperative.
Okay.
And so actually it's not obvious that cooperation and consciousness and for that matter, three C's, are bound together the way they are. But actually they're all forms of cooperation. Mm. And in order for cooperation to evolve, it has to be protected. And most non-human social groups, there's a lot of inequality within the group. So some individuals become dominant and they just take stuff right. from the other individuals. They would be despotic in terms.
You put those people in jail, so they don't do that.
Well, we do, but that's... right. And so what our ancestors evolved was the capacity to suppress that kind kind of group. Basically, the group evolved the capacity to dominate the would-be alpha individual. And right. at that point, you had a form of egalitarian, which was it was egalitarianism with attitude. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be guarded, because if you don't have that, then basically it's an unsafe social environment to be cooperative.
Right.
So that's the kind of groups that evolved in our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And among the many forms of cooperation that evolved, there were physical forms like hunting and gathering and offense and defense against predators and other groups.
Even agriculture is a cooperative sort of.
Well, very much so.
Right.
There's also mental forms of cooperation,
right.
including transmitting learned information across generations.
Right.
And symbolic thought. When you think of what it means to think in terms of symbols, then that's inherently communal. We need to have, these symbols have to have shared meaning.
Well, it's language itself.
And language is a very sophisticated forms of symbolic thought. Yeah. So just about everything distinctively human, including mental in addition to physical, is a consequence of becoming more cooperative. Mm. Now when we get into such things as spirituality, that's very much a matter of having a symbolic meaning system.
Right.
And if you look at religions, for example, which then... This is something that is a main part of my work. Mm-hmm. Then what you find is that our religion, more or less, Durkheim, if you remember what he said, got it right. Durkheim said that religion is a moral community centered around the concept of the sacred,
right.
That unites a community into a single moral community called a church. So. Mm-hmm. Our religion, in all of its aspects, is very much about the creation of moral communities. And spirituality is a part of that. Spirituality, almost by definition, is expansive and pro-social and other-oriented. If you're a spiritual person, you're just in your own nest.
But spirituality and morality are sometimes at odds almost. You know, there can be a moral that can suppress a spiritual expansion. I mean, I guess you're not talking about it in those terms, really. But you know what I'm saying? Morality isn't necessarily spiritual. It can be. You know, it cuts into the altruistic expansion of a person. It puts a codification on behavior. So I don't know if that's not really what you're talking about.
It is in a way. Often religion is said to have a vertical and a horizontal component.
Right.
The vertical component is your relationship with God.
Your personal relationship
with God. The horizontal component is your relationship with fellow people.
Mm-hmm.
And the horizontal part can become highly bureaucratic and sociological and
dogmatic. And
it can be dogmatic. And so when people distinguish between religion and spirituality, what they're often distinguishing is this sort of sociological element,
right.
The norms that you have to follow, the punishment if you don't, and so
right.
on, as opposed to the vertical dimension. And there's more to say about that, but I mean, even a dogmatic church has a vertical dimension. You still have your relationship with
right.
with God.
Right.
So there's a distinction between tight and loose cultures, which goes beyond religion. A tight culture has strong norms that are enforced, strongly enforced by punishment. A loose culture provides a lot more latitude for individuals.
Mm.
And those types of cultures are adaptive in different circumstances. So if you have a lot of existential insecurity and your whole culture is in danger, those tend to select for tight culture. Solidarity basically, you've got to do things as a group. You can't just do what you want, because that's how important it is to cooperate as a group. Your very existence can be threatened. When it's safe, then that's the time in which you can relax those kinds of group controls, and then individuals are free to follow their paths.
No, it's interesting you're saying that, because it seems like that's the crystallization of a lot of religions, is coming together as that group dynamics, you know, the Jews in the desert, the early Christian communities, probably the early Islamic communities, where they needed to come together in that tight-knit way in order to exert a force or a presence in the world. And now there seems to be a resistance against that. And it seems like we are, I hope, evolving away from those religious forms, because it seems like now it's in the way. Do you see that? Or
there's a lot of research on this, and this is where it's important to think like an ecologist and an evolutionist. We just said that these different forms, tight and loose, which exist in non-religious form in addition to religious form.
Right.
Actually, the focus on religion is not quite right.
Okay.
We should be focusing on meaning systems.
Okay.
And religions is one kind of meaning system.
Like communism or capitalism, is that a meaning system too?
Every normal person has a meaning system.
A personal meaning system.
Well, it can be cultural or it can be cultural species.
Mm-hmm.
That nobody gets out of bed in the morning without seeing the world through some cultural lens,
right,
which influences what they see, how they process it, and how it causes them to act.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the normal human condition, mm-hmm, is to rely upon our cultures one way or the other. And what we've just said is that if you build a really unsafe place, then what will evolve, and that again is in both senses. It could be in life. Instantaneous, just our psychological response. If you become threatened,
uh-huh,
in a moment you will become more conservative.
Uh-huh.
You will become tight, and you will want a tighter culture. Can happen in an afternoon. And so, safer place.
Right.
When it is, it will be a looser place. But if we make the world a more dangerous place, then it will become a tighter place. And what the hell else are we seeing right now?
Reaction, danger, false or real, but there seems to be,
and the perception,
yeah,
and if you look at the language of many religions, including fundamentalist religion, mm-hmm, regardless of the real safety of the world, they give a perceived threat that the world is a dangerous place and you need us in order to make it safe.
Right.
So this is all
counter to that. We're right now at a retreat with some people who are trying to push the envelope by feeling a new direction away from those imposed standards. You know, the purpose of doing this program is to show that there's an evolution of consciousness away from those tight structures, and that humans are free to explore new realities, other ways, even other meaning systems, because if you're in a tight culture, you don't have the freedom to explore new meaning systems. And I feel we are at a point of culture where the opportunity is to expand, because the old meaning systems don't seem to be working, because it's collapsing in on itself. So
yeah, and there's actually, it's complicated, so what I'm about to say might seem contradictory, but as we also know, crisis and collapse, it's also a time of innovation.
Right, I agree with that.
That's when you're very much prone to try new things, because what you were doing wasn't working.
But it's only it only can do with the innovation if in the collapse there's some, you know, in systems theories, there's a substructure that's starting to build on a new level of complexity. If it just collapses, then that's over, and then it's just, you know.
It's not inevitable that a phoenix will arise from the ashes.
But what we're doing is that we are the undercurrent, I feel, of this new system that's building within the collapse of the system that it's in now.
Yeah, we hope that's the case. And what we're reaching for is a
right.
So we see that there should be the moral circle should be expanded to be the whole earth, and then the way everything else is organized should be subordinated to that.
Right.
As our new French president said, you know, earth first.
Right. But just getting back to biology, is there a parallel between biological evolution as you see it and cultural evolution? You know, humans have evolved to be the great, you know, species, maybe whales and dolphins, but now, because through evolution, now, what is the equivalent of a culture that's, you know, as equipped as a human vehicle? You know what I'm saying? Are we evolving to a great culture that's as expansive and possibilities as the human is in its own biological evolution? Do you know what I mean?
Well, there's a utopic aspect to this and a dystopic aspect.
Oh, right.
If humans continue to dominate the earth, then that could be
right.
Its consequences. The best comparison, as my namesake E.O. Wilson has stated,
is he related? No,
only culturally.
Okay.
Is with the social insects, and once again, it's back to cooperation. So once this is called a major evolutionary transition.
Mm-hmm.
And it knows, so maybe we said enough about group selection to say that what it happens is that when the balance between levels of selection within group selection favors selfishness, between group selection favors cooperation. And so you can evolve mechanisms that suppress the potential for within group selection, then between group selection becomes so strong that the group becomes a new superorganism.
Right.
And this has happened. We have bacterial cells. We have nucleated cells as communities of bacterial cells. We have multicellular organisms. And in each case, this new higher-level organism becomes dominant on the Earth.
Right.
It does not replace the previous forms. There's still lots of bacteria around.
Mm-hmm.
But in the case of social insects, the origination of the social insects was a very rare event, only about a dozen, as far as we know, origination events. But once they evolved, they became so dominant that now over half the insect biomass is social insects.
Mm-hmm.
And what
because they were successful in their...
This higher-level organization is successful. Now, Wilson has correctly made the comparison that we are like a social insect colony.
Right.
And so that's what's enabled us to spread over the earth, and us plus our domesticated plants and animals. Now we dominate about half of the earth's surface, and it could keep on going. We could obliterate the rest of nature. That would not be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it might also speed our demise, because evolution has no foresight,
right?
Unless we impose it. So, part of what this group is attempting to do, and other groups are attempting to do, is to have an enlightened evolutionary process with more foresight, so that we could actually evolve more sustainable practices as opposed to unsustainable practices.
Well, as you showed me before on the show, the word sustainable. On the increase since 1980, where before then it was hardly ever used at all. So that's a good sign, isn't it?
Well, the word, what we showed using Google Ngram is that, of course, the word sustainability has a long history.
Right.
But it was used at a very low frequency.
Right.
Until about the 1980s.
Right.
When now it's shooting up like a rocket. And so what that said is that we haven't felt the need to be sustainable.
Right.
Until so very recently. Now we finally feel the need to be sustainable. That's why we're using the word right and left.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean we're doing it. So
it's a start. At least we're using it. At least it's in the awareness.
I mean,
do you see it happening? I mean, do you see a sustainable awareness more than before?
Sure I do, but it's something I think we have to work hard towards.
Harder than we are now.
A lot of narratives, religious narratives, scientific narratives, mm-hmm. portray this as kind of an unfolding or a development, mm-hmm. Which puts you in a passive frame of mind, as if it's just going to happen. And I think that we need to have another narrative that puts it in a more urgent frame of mind, mm-hmm. which is like, this is not going to happen unless we spring into action. Uh-huh. And as someone who studies religion, mm-hmm. then one of the most common Christian narratives, of course, it's the second coming, is right. that, you know, but we have to prepare. So the end of days is coming. We need to prepare.
Do you think that's true? Are you?
Well, a false narrative like that.
No.
Well, and you know, I have to go back. I just read a book called The Bet uh-huh. by, and what it's about is in the 1970s about. There was a lot of environmental concern, especially about population.
Right.
And Paul Ehrlich, you might know that name.
I have heard that
name. Became very influential as an ecologist who was basically calling for the need to curtail population with dire consequences if we don't do something right away.
Right.
And an economist named Simon, I have to remember his first name, took a kind of a free market approach right. that no, we don't have anything to worry about. The market economy will come up with solutions mm-hmm. for things, and made a bet with Ehrlich mm-hmm. about the price of five metals in a decade, and Ehrlich and all of his associates are saying, we're running out of all of our resources. Of course, these things are going to be much more expensive in the future. What actually transpired was Simon won the bet, not Ehrlich.
That we're not.
All those metals were cheaper 10 years later.
And why is that?
Because of all the supply and demand, basically, got there to be substitutes or
right.
better methods of extracting. Or right. So Simon was right over the short term.
Uh-huh.
And the environmentalists were being like way alarmist.
Mm.
Way alarmist.
So you think that's true now?
No,
you don't. You think we should be more alarmist.
Well, we have two responsibilities that conflict with each other.
Mm.
One is to raise concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And the second, to stick to the truth.
Mm.
And those really do conflict with each other. Because if you want to raise the alarm, it's just like terrible things will happen. Terrible things will happen.
You don't have to say it like that. Like, terrible things will happen. But if you don't take care of your garden, it's not going to produce. I don't think that's a terrible thing. I think that's just something that needs to be stated. So take action. I mean, you know, it's just real.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that we have all there's needed to alarm us in so many ways.
Well, the oceans, the fish, the die-offs of fish, you know, and radiation pouring into the Pacific from Fukushima. Nobody's talking about that. Do you ever look at that, the effect of radiation on evolving populations? I mean, is that something you look at?
I mean, with Chernobyl, it's the best thing that ever happened to the natural populations.
What do you mean?
Because humans moved out. The wildlife is flourishing. Who right. cares if their mutations rate have gone up?
Well,
and stuff like that?
But what about right now? The radiation pouring into the Pacific Ocean, just polluting people and fish and wildlife is. I mean, that's a concern for me. I mean,
sure it is. But what's a disaster in human terms?
Right.
Which would cause all sorts of suffering.
Yeah.
Is not going to eliminate populations. So the animal populations, they are now suffering from the expense of the effects of the radiation, but they still exist as populations.
Mm.
And if they're not being harvested by people, okay,
it'll be a good thing.
Or being excluded by people, there's actually is a net positive. Is that as bizarre as that might seem?
No, I understand. But getting to another question, because you said you study religion, do you feel consciousness or an eminent force is pre-creation, responsible for creation, or is consciousness a byproduct of creation? That's the old question. What's your personal opinion?
What do you mean by creation?
I mean existence. Is there a consciousness that created existence, a greater consciousness that brought this all into manifestation, or is this awareness thing we call consciousness an emergent property of matter coming together to produce life? So, I mean, I know it's an old question. I'm just curious where you're coming in on that.
For anyone in your audience who knows of Pierre Thiel de Chardin, he was quite prescient in the way that he thought about it. And what he thought is that the origin of the planet by a purely physical process.
Arbitrary means of gases coming together.
Yeah. There was no consciousness there. And the origin of life, again, was not due to a conscious process.
This is what he felt.
This is what I will claim.
Okay.
And, I mean, evolution is typically described as a blind process of
chance
selective
happening.
Retention.
You just
chance.
That's what you think. It's just.
Well, that's how it would have started.
Right.
But then I think consciousness would have emerged from the evolutionary process. And then consciousness would, you might say, take over the evolutionary process.
When you talk about consciousness, you mean intelligence
or guide the evolutionary process. Okay. And what Chardin said, it's really amazing as a Jesuit priest how all the temptations he avoided in terms of invoking divine sparks and things like that. So he said that in some ways, us humans are just another primate species, not much different than others. An odd combination of traits that resulted from a primate moving out into the savannah.
Mm-hmm.
But in other respects, we were a new evolutionary process, and that made us as momentous in its own way as the origin of life.
Mm.
And he asked us to imagine the bush of life, the bushy tree of life, expanding its many branches slowly. Mm. And then he asked you to imagine one twig on one branch of the bushy tree of life, all of a sudden proliferating much faster than the rest of the tree. Mm. And in no time, it's overtopped the tree. That would be the process of human cultural evolution. And then he asked you to imagine humans and in small-scale groups as tiny grains of thought, as he put it. And then these tiny grains of thought coalesce into larger grains of thought until ultimately there's a single global consciousness, which he called the Omega Point.
Mm.
Okay? So consciousness more or less begins with our species, as he would put it. I might contest that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then it grows in scale from tiny grains, our separate cultures, mm-hmm. to some planetary scale.
Right.
And that's not inevitable, as I say. That's something we have to steer towards.
What would it make that branch of humanity, if you use that analogy, grow so massively? I mean, there has to be some causation. It just doesn't take off to expand like that and to populate.
Well, it was the process of it goes back to cooperation. So now you have these hyper-cooperative small groups, and one of the ways they cooperated was by transmitting learned information across generations much, much more than other
efficiently.
Species. And
more
so
efficient.
Now we had, that was the new evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what enabled a human population to adapt to their environment.
It's cultural transmission as well as
yes.
biological. So
yeah.
Culture is what allowed humans to proliferate, the means of communication and all that. So do you believe there's something, well, maybe you don't believe something beyond the death of the body that survives, then? Is there, if you believe that's the process of consciousness, then it must not go beyond the biological. Or what do
you
think?
Well, culture goes beyond the...
No, but I mean the individual. Do they survive? Is there an aspect of the soul, I guess, the spirit soul, that survives? Or in the way you understand it? Or is there not? I mean, I'm just curious how you feel.
If I influence my culture,
yeah,
and if I die, the cultural influence remains.
But
so there is a form of immortality that comes from impacting one's culture.
Of course.
But no more than that. That's all that I'm...
You are may go beyond, you know, the essence of the human being may live beyond the body.
Well, don't underestimate what I just said.
Right.
I think what would be beyond that?
You know, the essence of a spirit. People have near-death experiences, say their body had died and they went to the other side and they were still a form of consciousness without a body. You know, I understand what you're saying. Of course, you have an influence based on...
Yeah, so I would exclude that. I would say that there's currently... that's outside what I call the boundary of methodological naturalism.
Of course it is, but I'm just saying about your personal belief. Is there you side with that? That's your...
Yeah, let me expand upon what naturalism is.
Okay.
So naturalism is a philosophical position that everything can be explained through natural processes without invoking any supernatural causes.
Okay.
And it comes in two forms. Philosophical naturalism is the strong claim. It's a truth claim.
Mm-hmm.
Methodological naturalism is a somewhat weaker claim that although maybe these things exist, but the fact is there's no principled way to study them. And so therefore, for methodical purposes, we're going to restrict our explanations to just the natural forces of nature that we know. Now, there's things we didn't know in the past, and so the boundary is flexible, but
right,
it's still important to recognize the boundary. Now, just to give some history to this, when Darwin was a young man, before he became a naturalist, he was going to become a doctor. And at that time, it was still an open question as to whether human physiological processes were motivated by some divine vital force, or whether the body was just a big mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's still a debate, but yeah.
For the most part, people concluded it was a physical mechanism. And I'm trying to remember the
which is still the current view. You know, it's still a physical mechanism.
And, you know, more or less for good reason. Even if with all the new stuff that we talk about nowadays, with the placebo effects and epigenetics and the kind of stuff that Bruce Lipton, for example, writes about, that's still a purely physical, physical process. And so even back then, you had people who regarded themselves as religious saying, at least we can say this: however God works, it is through the establishment of natural laws. It is not by intervening here and there and there again. And that's what methodological naturalism
is. I don't believe in that either, but I do believe, like people like Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, proving there's something that we have yet to include in that natural law. I mean, it's all natural law, whether people are telepathic or can influence each other at a distance. That's just something we have yet to understand. But that is, I mean, I disagree. It is observable and quantifiable in a way. We have to create new experiments to show what works. But I think people like Dean Radin are showing things that there is some unseen.
So there's two strategies. And I had some videos with Kurt Johnson on this topic.
Uh-huh.
And I think people like ourselves, I include you, there's two almost preferences.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. One wants to test the boundary of methodological naturalism,
right?
As you just said, yeah. Okay, there's something here's something that's on the edge, but maybe, you know, science will prove this, okay?
Well, it's still naturalism if it happens.
And then
yes,
someone such as myself will acknowledge that possibility, but here's my game. I want to explain as much as possible while remaining well within the boundaries of methodological naturalism, mm-hmm. stuff that's already totally accepted as natural processes. I want to know how much about such things as consciousness and these mind-body duality and these questions that we like to ponder, how much can be explained while remaining well within the bounds of methodological naturalism. I actually regard that as more important because we know that's a solid foundation. Mm-hmm. If you're pushing the edge of methodological naturalism, that's not a strong foundation. Why is it important for you to do that, I might ask, if in fact some good answers can be found with
those good answers aren't found, but they yet found in pushing the boundaries mm-hmm. of naturalism, then we have a good field of study because it seems like, to me, it hasn't answered those. Hasn't answered what a near-death experience is for people who have had those experiences or what psychic communication, which seems to happen. It's happened to me. I mean, so we need to create an expanded view of naturalism. That's just my point.
Well, sure. And first, I want to say this is not my area, so I don't want to pretend to be knowledgeable. But I do think there's many, many phenomenon
yes.
that people experience. Mm-hmm. It's very compelling for them because they experienced it. Right. But come to try to study it scientifically, and it's not easy.
No, it's not easy, but there are great beings, people who are formulating Rupert Sheldrake.
We're back to the 19th century.
We are back there.
With people trying to, so that's where we...
No, but I understand it's not your field, and I appreciate you, I appreciate the work you are doing, what was that book you mentioned about the four...
Evolution in Four Dimensions.
Yeah, that I thought was really... What are the four dimensions of those evolutions? Because that's something you do.
So this is a book that I actually often assign as the first text in my evolution courses. Mm-hmm. It's by Eva DeBlanca and Miriam Lamb.
Yeah.
And what it notes is that Darwin knew nothing about genes.
Right.
For him, evolution was about variation, selection, and heredity. Mm-hmm. A resemblance between offspring and their parents,
right?
Due to any mechanism. But with the advent of genetics in the early 20th century, mm-hmm. then evolution became very gene-centric, as if the only way for offspring to resemble their parents was by sharing genes.
Didn't they know about genetics with Mendelssohn back in the, whenever that was, Mendel?
Well, Mendel was a contemporary of Darwin, uh-huh. but his work was not recognized. Until the early 20th century. So the science of genetics was born in the early 20th century. And so what DeBlanca and Lamb do is they go back to basics and they discuss four mechanisms of inheritance. Those are the four dimensions of evolution. One is genetics.
Right.
The other is epigenetics, which is patterns in gene expression.
That can change.
As opposed to gene frequency. And uh-huh. so Bruce Lipton, if your audience is familiar with his work. Mm-hmm. The third is forms of social learning found in many species.
Cultural, you're saying.
It's cultural, yes, but it's basically the transmission of learned information.
Uh-huh.
And many species do that to a degree. And then the fourth, which is more distinctively human, is symbolic thought, including but not restricted to language. Uh-huh. And language, symbolic thought, creates a much greater diversity of variation to select upon.
Uh-huh.
A symbolic system is like a genetic system. With sexual reproduction, then you have almost an infinitude of genetic combinations. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And each one leads to a phenotype.
Uh-huh.
So you have this huge field of variation to select upon. A symbolic system is also like that. A symbolic system, there's so many elements that can be permuted that you have almost an infinite variety of symbolic systems, and each one results in a suite of behaviors.
Right.
So you have a symbotype-phenotype relationship that's similar to the genotype-phenotype relationship. And it's that which made humans so adaptable. It was their ability to transmit information encoded in symbolic a thought.
Right.
And when you, and so this is a magnificent book for basically expanding the view and taking what most people think of as outside the orbit of evolution. Because you say the word evolution to most people, they think genes.
Right.
And if it's not genes, if it's behavior or culture or something like that, they don't associate with evolution. Mm-hmm. Now with this expansion, everything, all of these things that are typically thought of as outside the orbit of evolution are brought inside the orbit of evolution. So it's a very exciting move. And I would certainly recommend that to all of your readers as a way to get current, basically, with what's happening now in evolutionary thought.
Well, just to jump on that, if that's true, this symbolic kind of reference, then we are in an incredible revolution now with the computer age and social media and apps and everything that's exponentially expanding our ability to communicate symbolically. That's like tenfold, a hundredfold than what it was even 20 years ago. So where that, do you take that into account and see where that?
Yeah, it's similar. It's not the first time.
Right.
So well, the advent of writing, you would
count. The proliferation
the advent of print.
Yeah, but what's happening now is seems like it's on such a massive scale worldwide. Those were cultural things that spread over time. This is like an instant global sensation.
20s results in a massive increase in scale. Mm-hmm. And so you can look at the consequences of that. They enable communication to take place, obviously, at a much larger scale than they did before.
Right.
So if you didn't have these things, the idea of a planetary brain would probably be impossible. Mm-hmm. But given that you have these things, that does not make a planetary brain inevitable. Mm-hmm. You need that plus more. You need to wire the brain. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, then this could as easily lead to despotic regimes. This could lead to Big Brother or Little Brother.
By wiring, isn't the internet the wiring of the global brain?
No.
No?
No.
Okay. What would be a wiring of a global brain?
Well, if you look at a real brain, it is, it has so many different circuits that have evolved to solve specific adaptive problems. The amount of engineering that goes into the brain, thanks only to is what makes the brain what it is. This is also true for meaning systems. So meaning systems I define as a set of beliefs and practices that take in information and process it in a way that leads to effective action. Mm-hmm. That is word for word the same as the definition of a brain.
Right.
So the meaning system is the brain of a culture.
Okay.
So isn't that interesting? But for the internet, that's just the raw material. But that raw material has to be fashioned by a selection process before it can function.
Well, isn't that
as a brain.
What we're seeing now? Because we're just in the infancy of that? I mean, I don't know if we're seeing that. I'm saying, is it possible that we are seeing a selection process that will codify and refine itself and come into a coherency at some point so we can have a global human brain? Do you think that's possible?
So that brings us back to multi-level selection.
Right.
That selection can favor selfishness or altruism.
Right.
So let's say that the internet gets in the hands of a powerful few.
Right.
And they find a way to be totally invasive. So now they know everything about us.
Like the NSA.
Or commercial interests.
Right.
And so now they're all using it for their purposes.
Uh-huh.
And we become slaves.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right. Well,
that's one outcome.
That's one possibility. I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, why not?
Because it's already too diversified for it to be contained by a select few. It's already such an integral part of global culture. To, for a few to co-opt that would be create a rallying against that for the altruistic or whatever, just the communal output and the restriction that that would impose. I think that would be hard to do at this point. They may have been able to do that 20 years ago, but now.
Well, I think it's enough to say that this is one dystopic outcome.
Yes.
That's possible. It would behoove us all to become smart about cultural evolutionary processes so that we can let the cooperative output, the more utopic outcome, beat out the dystopic outcome.
Do you think that's actually possible?
I think it's theoretically possible, but all of our ingenuity and intelligence is going to be required. Mm-hmm. And it requires, minimally, it requires more people to become literate about evolution. It's extraordinary when you think about it. The people use the keywords evolution, mm-hmm. adapt, all of these things in the vernacular.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't cross their minds that there's a theory out there that's been under development for a long, long time within the biological sciences that might have something to contribute
so
to that.
So tell us what we would need to know as a population in order to make that utopian and movement possible. What would you?
Well, you'd need to become more literate about what's called multi-level selection, and we've given a taste of that here.
Right.
More literate about cultural evolution. I'll name a few more books here for your audience.
Yes. Okay.
My own book is called Does Altruism Exist? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's easy to remember.
Yes.
There's another book called The Secret of Our Success by Joseph Henrich, which is about the latest on cultural evolution.
All right.
And then a book called Ultra Society is about the last 10,000 years of history as a process of cultural multi-level selection, mostly fueled by warfare.
Mm.
So how 10,000 years of war made us the greatest cooperators on Earth.
Mm.
And so between group selection has always two faces, basically. There's the between group part, which can be conflictual, need not always be, but can be.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the within group part, which is the good stuff, the cooperation. And the reason that our societies exist at the scale that they do is because of a 10,000 year process of competition among groups, mostly in the form of warfare. But to succeed in warfare, you have to succeed economically.
Right.
So those are joined at the hip.
Right.
So, it's the world needs to become more literate about this before we can basically manage the evolutionary processes.
Right. Well, thank you for all this. One last question is, do you think it's possible that life in its own, in this sort of form, could have evolved in other parts of the universe in a similar way? Or
yes, the answer to that would be probably yes.
And do you think we've made contact or not yet? Is there any signs for you that there's...
No, and there's a good bet that life could have existed, could have arisen many times, mm-hmm. but not led to the kind of human-like intelligence that would be able to communicate interplanetarily.
Right.
When you think of how long it took for us to come along, there was nothing ordained about it. And there's a lot of debate within my own field as to whether human-like intelligence could, there's any kind of inevitability to that. What you think of what you need is two things. You definitely need a major evolutionary transition.
What's the transition from what to what?
From basically these new higher-level superorganisms.
Right.
So you need to have these hyper-cooperative groups.
Yes.
And then, now that happened before with the social insects, right?
Right.
So the social insects are genuinely superorganisms, but they're never going to communicate. They're never going to do more than gather honey.
Exactly.
So you need more than that.
Yeah.
You need to have that event taking place in a species that's already very smart as individuals, And then you need this process of cultural evolution, this symbolic thought to take off. And it's only at that point that you might get a species which is capable of communicating outside its planet. So that's a combination of rare events. We have many planets too.
Right, we have probably billions of planets. Do you think it's possible, just as a guess, that they actually do exist, other intelligent, maybe not human in this form, but in some kind of intelligent way, that they could actually exist now?
Sure, yeah, that's...
It's sort of where I like to go and to thinking possibilities of... I think an evolution for humanity would be meeting these beings that would infuse our limited culture with new possibilities.
Then there's the question as to whether they'd be friendly.
Right. Well, I think
our own history of conquest, why would we be colonizing other planets than to plant our own seed? Mm-hmm. So the idea that inhabitants would be anything other than in a conquest situation where they would be taking over this planet for themselves would be another
unless we exist within a universe, a unified field where the troubles or the vibrations we're sending out in war is affecting kind of harmony
in my book you passed the boundary of methodological naturalism.
I thought I didn't want to push you past, but I get where that boundary is.
I think it's much more fun to play within the sandbox of methodological naturalism. Don't even try to expand the boundaries of the sandbox.
Right.
There's gold to be had underneath our feet, my friend.
Right, which we have yet to discover.
Working with what we know exists, there's all kinds of things that we can do to solve our problems.
Right.
And I often think that these other thoughts are a distraction. They're entertaining as far as they go, but really, with the tools that we need in order to improve our societies, they're much more mundane tools than that. Mm-hmm. And if we need to keep our eye on that job.
Right. And I appreciate that, and I'm glad there's people like you working in that area to bring humanity into a more compassionate way of just existing with ourselves.
Sure. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. I've been talking to David Sloan Wilson. Do you have a website? Do you have a...
I go to the Evolution Institute website, or This View of Life. This View of Life is our online magazine.
And Does Altruism Exist is your latest book.
Yep.
And you're a professor at the
Binghamton University in New York.
State University of New York at Binghamton. Great. Thanks for spending some time here.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Okay. Thank you for listening. It's Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you have any questions, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thank you and good night.